substance equals spurn. The propaganda's a win, stress feeding on my tension. My countrymen, they love their fiction. Words are now displayed with good intentions.
Welcome to 1-200, the politics and media podcast. Welcome to another week of current events. I'm joined by my co-host, Bronco, all the way from the United States of America, but here in Aotearoa this week. How are you doing?
Kia ora. Good. Can't complain. The world is... The fire that the world was set on has... The flames have slightly receded for a week, so, you know, that's good.
Fantastic. Lots to talk about. We've got international politics. We've got domestic politics. We'll try and get through a bunch of it. Let's start with your favorite topic, Bronco, the man that you have devoted your journalistic life to reporting about, one Joe Biden, the current, but not for much longer, president of the United States of America. You wrote probably the best biography of him to try and scupper his chances of being the president, and everything in it came true.
Well, I mean, I don't know if I'd frame it like that. I don't think the idea was to scupper his chances. I think the idea was to say, here's a guy that you know nothing about, and here's what his actual history and record is. And I mean, the reason it came true is because it was all true. You know, I didn't really make a prediction in the book. I think I said that he may not win the election, and he almost certainly won't carry out the kind of change that's needed in the United States to basically move it off the pathway that led to Trump. So that was my only kind of tepid prediction in what was otherwise kind of like a history of his life or his career. But I mean, it is true that basically that ended up being accurate, which like, for no, it wasn't always clear it was going to be accurate. I thought maybe he, at first, for the first, I don't know, two, three months, I thought, okay, maybe this guy is going to surprise us. But then, no, he did not surprise us at all. He did the almost everything that you would expect Joe Biden to do, just kind of refracted through this era of kind of populism and radicalism and class warfare.
There were no hard predictions, but just by outlining what he'd been doing in his political career, there are very clear indications of what he'd do with the major issues of the day, right? And, you know, as we've seen with, do we just call it the Gaza Holocaust at this point, honestly, the acceleration of the genocide since 2023 in Palestine, he was a lifelong Zionist. You know, he's been one of the strongest supporters of the Israeli state and of their colonial project there. And that's evidenced throughout his political career. And that's what he did for the last, what, nearly 2 years.
Yeah, I mean, what's interesting about Biden is people do have this understanding of him as a guy who has been a staunch, you know, pro-Israel guy from the very beginning, a guy who believed in Israel as an idea and, you know, was passionate about it from his early age. That's how he sells it. You know, his dad told him a story about the Holocaust and World War II, and it pressed upon him as a child. Oh, actually, his dad would regularly talk about this at a dinner table, and it made Joe Biden go, oh, this, you know, this is a really important thing.
But it's actually not true. Oh, I want to be president.
Right, yeah. But that's not true. Biden, there is evidence, but there was a scandal very early on in his very first campaign about basically this campaign volunteer left Biden's campaign, went to the press because he was like, this guy is full of shit, basically. This guy says that he's a huge Israel supporter, but basically what he said behind the scenes was that he can't make his views, his actual views on Israel and the Palestine conflict public because it'd be political suicide. So he is just going to say what people want him to say, and he's going to take that position for the rest of his career. And there's other evidence to show that was the case, you know. That you know, there's documents Biden dealing with local pro-Israel groups in Delaware, talking about how they meet with him and they said, Biden says that he's willing to change his opinion or change his stance in certain things, and so he slowly from there on, through his 70s became a much more ardent kind of for lack of a better word, a lackey for the Israeli government. And that's kind of one of the mysteries of this whole thing is that Biden took this ardently pro-Israel position because of politics, purely because he thought it would help in the elections. But this horrible crime that he has committed, probably what I mean, not probably one of the most heinous things we've seen in the 21st century, at least. It completely destroyed his presidency, and it destroyed his re-election chances. It destroyed his party. There's now there was a poll that came out that talked about how that was the biggest reason for non-voters
29%.
previous Biden voters, who stayed out. So it's like what happened? It was it the case that Biden started out taking this position due to politics purely, and then he came to convince himself that he really believed this stuff. He became a really ardent Zionist over time. Is it that he still is just doing this for political reasons, but he has not been informed by his advisors, who we know have kind of manipulated him and kept information from him? He was not informed by them about the actual peril he was putting himself and his own party into. I don't really know yet. I don't know if any of us can say for sure. Maybe we'll find out in the coming years. Although at this point, it seems like kind of a moot point.
Yeah, so he's gone in 2, 3 days, and one of the immediate and just like ridiculous, I think, outcomes of the inauguration of Donald Trump, the election of Donald Trump, is right, like even before he's been inaugurated, one of his guys has somehow managed to get a ceasefire on the table that everyone is kind of saying is the best opportunity to do that since it began. And obviously no one should trust Trump and no one should trust Israel to follow through on this, right? We've seen the ceasefire kayfabe again and again and again, where Israel kind of agrees to a ceasefire and says, oh no, Hamas disagreed with it, and the entirety of the Western media reports the Israeli line, and then Israel massacres hundreds of more Palestinians. And also every time during the ceasefire period, as it closes in on the ratification date, they'll make sure to try and bomb as many tents as possible, right? Kill as many children as possible before they're going to be required to stop hostilities. But the immediate thing it's done is given the lie to what Biden had been saying and what the administration had been saying about their efforts to get something across the line. Biden has been kind of in defense mode over this, saying, oh, this is actually my deal from last year, from I think May 2024. And it immediately leads you to ask, okay, then why didn't you enforce that? Why didn't you, why did you, if you had a deal and everyone had kind of agreed to it and then Israel backed out, why did you just keep giving them money and arms?
Yeah, I mean, it is the deal from May, but the problem is that there's been many deals, and the issue is that Netanyahu and his far-right coalition don't want to have a deal, and so they need to be pressured into it, and that's the thing that was missing from the Biden administration. And so basically, the consensus in reporting about this, and it's just been said outright by Arab officials and others, that Trump sending his real estate friend as
Witkoff.
his envoy to Israel was the first time Israel has faced any actual pressure, short of, I guess, Biden having the occasional phone call with Netanyahu, yelling and swearing at him, and then giving him everything he
Reportedly
wants
yelling and
anyway,
swearing at him.
and then later leaking it out that he swore at him. So yeah, it's I mean, it is important to know, to keep in mind that it's a very fragile ceasefire agreement. Basically, I think to ensure that it actually sticks, that it actually becomes something permanent, Trump will have to exert more pressure on Netanyahu, and so that's the difficulty now, is making it clear that it's worth Trump's while to continue to force Netanyahu to abide by it, because otherwise Netanyahu basically is selling it, and they're openly talking about the idea of, after the first 42-day phase of no fighting, that they'll just restart things. Because the idea is the first phase, you're meant to have ongoing negotiations through then, that will then lead to phase two and three, which leads to the permanent ending of the war. And so if something happens in that first phase that means the negotiations end or go to an impasse, then they are free to continue killing people. And so that gives a lot of wiggle room for Netanyahu to just find anything he can to keep the thing going. So yeah, it's a cause for celebration. I mean, I'm very heartened by the fact that it's happened. It's the best chance so far of it actually ending. But whether or not we will actually see an end to this just endless parade of murder, it depends on whether Trump is actually going to keep pressuring Netanyahu, or if he's going to let him basically make a fool out of him the same way that Netanyahu made a fool out of Biden, and if he's going to be allow himself to be humiliated by the US's own client state.
Yeah, I think this is like one of the other ways in which it's more hopeful. Because if there's one thing that Trump does hate, it's being made a fool of, and having someone scupper his deal, right? You get the feeling that part of the reason he wanted to do this is to show that he can make the best deal, that he's the guy who's gonna solve this when nobody else could. It's like purely ego. And yeah, it will be interesting to see how that interplay occurs with Netanyahu, who is just a monster, who will almost certainly try and make things worse, unless Trump has like some kind of sweetener for him to make it look like he is still out on top in this, because he wants to be the big guy. I mean, the other side to this is, cessation of hostilities in Gaza. Meanwhile, they've ramped up in the West Bank, both settlers, Israeli occupying forces, the Palestinian Authority on behalf of Israel has also been attacking resistance and just civilians in the West Bank. You've still got the situations in Lebanon, Syria, and Yemen, where Israel and the US are active. And so there's this other risk that, okay, we'll put Gaza on hold so we can kind of get into some other wider activities, right?
Yeah, I mean, it wouldn't be good for Trump's domestic goals. I mean, Trump's whole thing is he wants to come in and he wants to pass a massive tax cut for the ultra rich, and then while also like slashing and burning everything. And so that's going to be potentially hard to do if this continues to be a live issue. So that does offer some hope that he will, try and rein in Netanyahu. But the question at the end of it all is, I think, like, is Israel actually able to be controlled by the government that basically funds its entire military effort and keeps it afloat? Because at the moment, suddenly it seems like when it's a Democrat in the White House, Israel does whatever it wants with impunity. The question is, can it do that with a Republican, with Trump in the White House? Seems like, based on this initial reporting, no, but we could very well find out that Netanyahu, at the end of the day, finds his own, personal political interests a lot more important than playing nice with Trump. We don't know. It's all speculation
Yeah.
at
And
this
because there's
point.
been
But
no
what's
pressure, like to date, we don't know how they're going to respond to that.
I mean, Trump may very well have to face the same choice that Biden faced, which is, does he cut off military aid? Does he turn the tap off so that Netanyahu cannot physically actually continue to wage the war? Which is not a extreme, but obviously, if a country is out there just wantonly slaughtering women
Yeah,
and
I
children,
mean, you're required to.
it's not remotely controversial to say, hey, we're not going to give you guns to kill these people anymore. But even in the scope of US history and US politics, this is not controversial. Plenty of presidents have done that or used the threat of doing that to make Israel stop. Most notably Ronald Reagan, who people out there who know a little bit about politics may recall that Reagan was not exactly some kind of peacenik dove type figure. So yeah, I mean, what's been remarkable though, besides the fact that this entire thing gives the lie to what we've heard from so many pro-democratic pundits for the past year and a bit, oh, as if Biden can just make this stop whenever he wants. Oh, as if there's a magical button that he can just press. Besides that, I mean, you're just seeing really, in some ways, wonderful candor from the Biden administration as they leave the White House. And you have somebody like Ambassador Jack Lew, ambassador to Israel, talking about how, oh yeah, we didn't tell them to end the war. We basically never told them to do anything. We placed no pressure on them to do anything. You have people like him and Tony Blinken and Jake Sullivan talking about how, when they came into Israel, oh yeah, they were talking about how they wanted to kill everyone in Gaza. Everyone in Israel was intent on
Yeah.
killing women and
And so we had
children.
to support their domestic policy.
You have Biden. He just did an interview with Lawrence O'Donnell. He's this anchor on MSNBC, and he's talking about how he had a phone call early on, a phone call with Netanyahu, and Netanyahu told him, and Biden said, "Well, yeah, I told him I can't. You can't just carpet bomb a place. You can't just indiscriminately bomb people." And Netanyahu said, "Well, you guys did it. You guys did it in World War II," and Biden proceeds to not only explain, obviously, that despite Netanyahu literally making the case to him calmly and plainly that he plans to do war crimes and he's completely justified doing so, and that Biden then proceeded to, for a year plus, give him, 2,000 pound bombs and stuff so that he could obliterate entire residential neighborhoods to get to these
Well,
tunnels
he
that
quoted
Netanyahu.
Dresden, didn't he?
But so not only that, but then Biden actually, in the course of this interview, refers to what Netanyahu is talking about as a quote legitimate argument. So, people for an entire year have been saying Israel has the most moral army in the world. This is the most accurate, precise military campaign that's ever been launched by anyone. Israel is such precision when it does everything it can to minimize casualties, so on and so forth. Biden in one interview goes, "Oh yeah, Netanyahu told me he was going to kill everyone, but he had to do it, and I thought that made sense." Just completely obliterates all of that propaganda. So I mean, it's quite incredible to watch all of that crumble in the space of just a few days as this just woeful, odious administration leaves its post.
And the way that Western media have just propped that up, it's Biden wasn't putting pressure on the United States and our fourth estate. Biden wasn't putting pressure on Israel, and the fourth estate wasn't putting pressure on the administration to answer what it was doing to like press them on these points that are now just coming out everywhere, right? That they weren't actually pressuring Israel at all. Like they'd been told about war crimes. Despite getting up on the podium again and again and again, like John Kirby, Matt Miller, et cetera, to say, oh, we don't know anything about that. Like, oh, no, Israel have investigated and they found nothing wrong. I couldn't possibly talk to you about the Genocide Convention. Oh, Hand Rajab, I haven't even seen any reports, but we're just waiting to hear what Israel says about it, Like, all these atrocities, which they have been questioned about by some members of the press corps, but have just palmed off again and again and again, and then the big Western media outlets have not only failed to interrogate, but in cases of outlets like the New York Times, intentionally taken some of the most egregious genocide apologia and justification and published it for weeks and weeks and weeks, right? And watching that get unpicked and suddenly, CNN, 60 Minutes, over the last week or so, suddenly doing these pieces about, oh, wow, there's horrible stuff happening in Gaza, has been pretty foul.
Yeah, I mean the media, the Western media, has a fairly sizable role of complicity in all this. I mean, you know, it's I'm of two minds about it. On the one hand, because there genuinely has been a lot of great reporting on this stuff in a lot of establishment outlets across the world. There's a lot of stuff that we wouldn't know were it not for that. And they also have reported on a lot of the kind of most terrible things. I mean, there's a reason why, despite everything, this war is so unpopular and disliked, and people want to end the world over, despite the fact that governments have the exact opposite view. The problem is that I think it's less an issue with individual reporting or journalists, and the problem is really it's people in positions of editorial decision making and management,
And we've seen it happen
because
come through the BBC with the Owen Jones report, right?
Absolutely. New York Times
New York
too.
Times had one too, yeah.
You know, I mean everywhere. And what you hear again and again is that you know, these lower level reporters in Canada, the CBC in Canada as well, lower level reporters, they want to be able to talk about stuff. They want to be able to accurately report, but it's the editors who say, well, you can't say this, you can't use this term, you can't use this kind of framing, you can't talk about Palestinian statehood. You know, you can't use the word genocide, so on and so forth. You have to change the framing here. And so that all of that ends up kind of burying, unless you're someone, you know, if you're active on social media, you might come across different perspectives, or if you're
Palestinian
someone who's
journalists, for example, who are on the ground, right?
or if you're someone who is familiar with this topic to begin with, you might, you know, having all that kind of reserves of historical knowledge and context, you would be a little more wary and be able to read between the lines when you read reporting. But otherwise, a lot of people, you know, they have to sift through this stuff and make sense of it. And so, yeah, I mean, a lot of the time, it's not even the fact that there isn't stuff that's being reported, although don't get me wrong, there's definitely stuff that has not been reported by outlets. But it's also about what is the emphasis? What is the volume of coverage leaning towards? You know, how are these things framed? You know, if readers and viewers and listeners constantly hear about October 7th, which is obviously a heinous incident, but it was one incident that happened over a year ago. If they constantly hear about that, but then they hear far less about the daily October 7th that are visited on daily and weekly October 7th that are visited on Gazans, then all of that kind of buries some of the outrage. And again, those are editorial decisions made at the top of the heap rather than, you know, by individual reporters.
Yeah, we had a good article published this week by Kieran Kelly, a genocide researcher, called "The Monster Making Machine." Kind of unpicking the role of those decision makers of the editorial departments and Western media in creating an environment where genocide could happen, right? But there is a level of like opt-in ignorance to that as well, I think. And you know, any number of reporters who are trying to get the story out also had actions they could take. I'm not as willing to let all media workers off the hook at this point. And especially in New Zealand, where we have just not had coverage at all for the most part. It's actually been bizarre. I'm waiting for something to come out similar to the BBC or NYT, where people are like, yeah, we just weren't allowed to publish on this stuff. A lot of the media outlets here use syndicated news providers like AP, AFP, Reuters. And we know that those providers are publishing, you know, reportage about the genocide, you know, especially when it comes to some of the big changes from NGOs last year, who like Amnesty did a 12-month investigation and then named it as a genocide, right? Those conglomerate reporters will report on those facts, but the New Zealand media won't pick those up. They will pick and choose which articles they syndicate, and almost 100% of them have a heavy IDF and Israeli bias. To the extent that many of them are still using debunked figures from October 7th, they're still talking about or discussing, the Hamas-run health ministry, all these things which are like in the distant past of Israeli propaganda or Hasbara are still getting to New Zealand audiences in a way which is just frightful to me. And there's a really interesting kind of set of interactions yesterday. I think Blinken was up on the podium, and a couple of reporters, Max Blumenthal and Sam Husseini, decided to speak out and were
You
trying to
mean
get,
random guys that were
yeah,
there for
random guys,
no
random
apparent reason?
demonstrators, some protesters.
Well, they were literally described as it was a man dragged out for asking questions, which is, I
Yeah,
guess, a way of
true.
describing journalists thrown out for applying scrutiny.
But that's like a perfect example of the way that the wider media environment just elides what has actually happened, right? Because, oh no, we're just saying the facts. I mean, yes, technically you are, but both of them were bodily removed.
I mean, well, to be fair, he was a man,
He was a
and he
man, he was
was
trying to ask
asking questions.
questions.
It's like reporting on a firefighter running into a burning building to save a cat, and then be like, "Man wanders out of house on fire."
Exactly. And one of the most stunning things about that, I think Sam Husseini was asking about the Genocide Convention or had been attempting to and wasn't being answered. And then he was, at the time he was started being removed, he was quiet, and they come along and then he starts to like yell out at Blinken, saying he should be in The Hague. The way the rest of the press pack responded to that, just put their heads down and avert their eyes and like play by the rules was pathetic. I could, yeah, I just.
It's very sad. I mean, those briefings are such a joke as
Oh,
well.
yeah.
And so, I mean, I guess probably part of it is decorum, wanting to maintain a sense of decorum. Part of it is wanting to not jeopardize their own access. But I mean, what? Why? This is the
At
end
this
of
point,
this
yeah, like
administration.
you're about to move into the Trump era. What are
And
you doing?
to be honest, the only worthwhile thing about those briefings is, and like being able to ask those questions, is the occasion where you were able to kind of trap the State Department spokesperson into either not being able to give a coherent answer on something, or kind of refusing to answer some kind of question. But I mean, a lot of it is just listening to a bunch of I'm sorry, but bullshit. It's just them. It's like watching a trapeze artist work, or some kind of highway act. You're like, wow, this is really impressive. How is he going to get out of this one? Oh, he did it.
Oh, he
Incredible.
smirked again, right?
Right. Oh, I mean, that Matt Miller, just there was an incident from some months ago where Husseini, the man, the
The
complete
man
random
removed
guy
for asking
who
questions.
a clear random guy who wandered into that briefing for no real reason. Where Sam Husseini asked, called out Miller for smirking constantly because he has this permanent smirk on his face
Yeah.
while he's discussing the murder of civilians and Israel, bombing residential buildings and flattening everyone inside. And he points out that he's smirking as he's doing it. And Miller gets very offended. How dare you? How dare you point out that I'm grinning about the death of children. And for once in the year plus that he's been out there lying to reporters, Miller's permanent smirk goes away. And
Yeah.
it proves Husseini's point entirely, because you see what his face looks like when he's not doing that stupid grin, and you're like, oh yeah, no, he really, because he's offended. He's personally offended that he has been called out by this guy in such a public way. And so it kind of proves his point. Oh, you really have just been smirking away through this. Just very quickly to the thing you mentioned about New Zealand media. I mean, I think what's particularly disappointing and not good about this is that it's actually pretty pertinent to our politics and New Zealand foreign policy for us to hear about this stuff, for people in New Zealand, for Kiwis to be informed about what the United States is doing. Because should I mention that we are a security partner of the United States? We are in the Five Eyes Alliance. This is a country that we don't have a military alliance with, but we have a very close and deepening partnership with. And it's one that New Zealand, without almost any public debate, from what I can see, is kind of drifting closer and closer towards, even as Washington foreign policy becomes more reckless and irresponsible and irrational. And so, we are constantly told in New Zealand we have to side with whatever United States elites in Washington want to do because of the rules-based order. We have a an investment in the rules-based order existing and continuing to function. That's true. I agree with that. We do have an investment. We want international law to be a real thing. We want there to be rules of the road for how states behave. We don't want it to just be anarchy and dog eat dog. But if that's the case, I mean, maybe New Zealanders should be made aware of the fact that our close security partner has through this war launched probably the most aggressive assault on that international order that we have ever seen, far outdoing, even a country like Russia, and far outdoing a lot of other states that we are told that we are meant to fear. Maybe that might impact the way that we think about foreign policy, the way that we think about how New Zealand's foreign policy, the direction it should go, if people were aware of this. So the fact that this is not covered at all, the actions of our own close partner undermine the thing that was meant to be a core New Zealand foreign policy interest, that is a real failure by the press.
Almost makes you think of it's intentional. A really interesting thing, I mean, similarly around that is, the failure of the other people in the press pack, the failure of the Biden administration, and the failure of all the outriders who were describing Sam and Max as just demonstrators to actually call this out is giving permission for what they have described as a fascist government coming under the Trump to be far more heavy-handed. Because they're making this point, look, no, you threw these guys out. They didn't have to do that. They didn't have to do that. They didn't have to like create a narrative 3 days before the Trump administration arrives for a president who has very intentionally attacked journalists, not big media outlets necessarily, but journalists, like turned his supporters and the people at his rallies on media workers who are trying to cover his events. And for barely even a perceived like breach of decorum, they have enabled a discourse around, oh, if someone asks you something you don't like, you're allowed to pick them up. You're allowed to get your security or your thugs to pick them up and throw them out. And the lack of reflection from Democratic outriders around this, because they're so thirsty to support their administration, their guy, Joe Biden, and like their Matt Miller, their Tony Blinken. I think I saw one guy saying, oh, Anthony Blinken is a great stand-up guy, and like people should abide by decorum in these situations and not make him feel bad, essentially. Like, just embarrassing. Like, what does freedom of the press actually mean at this point? Like, this is that kind of
Well, it's good that we're at this late stage thinking about what's important, Tony Blinken's feelings. That when I think about the past year and a half and of all the images I've witnessed and the things that I have read, the thing that sticks out to me is thinking, I hope Tony Blinken's okay. I hope he's dealing with this. Oh, there must be so much pressure to be this hated while you're carrying out a campaign of mass murder against the civilian population. That must be hard emotionally.
Well, I mean, I'm not going to say credit to Tony Blinken, but at least in comparison to Matt Miller, he looks like he wants to die most of the time.
That is true. That is the one saving grace. That there, it's clear in his face that somewhere deep inside, he knows that he is going to hell if there is one. That he is a bad person. That he has disgraced himself. Even if he kind of is able to deliver a speech pretty well.
Just this kind of acquiescing before they've even been made to do it, right? By the wider media, by all the political insiders. Oh, you know what? We're not just going to like fall in line for Trump. We're gonna set the stage for him. Thank you, everybody. See you later. And
Yeah, I mean it's going to be difficult for, I mean difficult will be necessary. I hope that Trump being in power will now force Democrats and Democratic supporting liberal people to actually start, criticizing US foreign policy again now that it's Trump doing it instead of the nice old liberal Democrat. But it will be hard for them to kind of pivot because, at least at first, because how can they call out Trump for anything he does from here? And he will do terrible things on Gaza and the West Bank, but just in general. But how are they going to call him out when the rejoinder is, well, you oversaw the you backed a president that killed more journalists than had been killed in the entire total of conflicts leading up to this combined. And you didn't say anything. You had literally nothing to say. You had nothing to say. You didn't do anything about it. You barely cared. And then suddenly we're supposed to believe that you are concerned about this.
And it's that constant like drum they're beating during the election, right? Oh, Trump's a fascist, yada yada yada. Oh, we'll just hand over the reins of power, all good. It just completely pulls the rug out from under themselves. It's embarrassing.
We have to commit a genocide to prevent fascism. You don't understand.
Yeah, no,
That's
this is
just
the
how it is.
argument, right?
It,
And
I mean
Trump will
that
immediately do worse.
the crazy thing is, I mean the U.S. political system is so at the moment unstable and warped that what the situation is like. If Trump had been the one who was president when October 7th happened and presided over what we have witnessed over the past year and a bit. Similar to the Yemen thing when he was president and how nobody cared when it was Obama and Biden, there would have been people screaming bloody murder in Congress and in the media. They would have been saying, this is fascism. Look, we have a fascist in the White House and he is carrying out a genocide. This is the nightmare that we all thought was going to happen. It's a nightmare that I thought was going to happen when Trump was first elected. But it didn't happen to Trump. It happened under the liberal antidote to Trump. It happened under the guy who said, I'm trying to heal the soul of the nation from this fascist. I'm the guy who believes in decency and the rule of law, and I have empathy and I have tragedy in my life that makes me empathize with people who have suffered. It happened under him. And it happened because, number one, the Republicans support, the miseration of the Palestinians. And then it happened number two because Democrats, their main priority is we have to be loyal to our president, and so we can't criticize him. So there was no, aside from the left, the few leftists in Congress and obviously people in the streets who were who did everything they could to try and stop this and actually save this shitty party from its own suicide. There was no one to really criticize this, and so the you get this paradox in US politics right now, where actually the far right leader is the one under which you can actually have criticism of US foreign policy. You can have a chance to actually obstruct and prevent a terrible foreign policy disaster, a crime of this proportion. And it's under the Democrat and the liberal, supposed anti-fascist candidate that it's actually more likely that the United States will carry out something this just awful and evil, frankly. And for that to be the case, that is a very, very sick sign of what the case is in US politics right now. It points to a deeply dysfunctional system beyond even the things that we usually think about when we think about the US system's dysfunction right now.
Well, this is a thing, right? Like, and it's up in the air as to how that wider liberal base will act. Some of them have been acquiescing immediately. We've seen in other Western countries like the UK, the plan was just to go further right than the right wing party. And I think some of the mask of, even liberal American politics is fascist, especially when it's abroad, has been torn away here. They're already attacking Trump for having a phone call with Xi Jinping, right? Like, because that was something that the Democrats wanted. They wanted a fucking conflict with China. And so there's this real sense that they're both immediately beginning to hit left. You know, they're black. Oh, we should never listen to anyone on the left again. And at the same time, saying, "Oh, Trump isn't fascist enough on these particular like foreign policy issues. We're the ones who will start a hot war with China. You can't trust this guy." It's horrific. And yeah, I just don't have much, and never have, I guess. So biased, maybe in that sense, have much hope for American liberalism. I don't think it's real. It's a facade. It's just a happy face they plaster over similarly awful abuses. One of the like really I guess predictable things of this Biden presidency is that he ran on the Obama kind of legacy, and Obama's real legacy was to set the ground for Trump, and Biden's done the same again.
Yeah, I mean the last kind of thing he had is he had to hang his legacy on was that he was the guy who beat Trump. But in the end, Biden has actually handed the country back to a emboldened, far more radical, and actually far more powerful Trump. Trump did not have, I think, the same kind of legitimacy that he does now, as a result of the election victory he just won, an election victory that is deeply connected to Biden's 4 years as president. So, the one thing I would note, just, whether liberals or the public as a whole or conservatives, the American public is overwhelmingly against this war. And the problem is that that is not reflected in the halls of power in the United States,
As across the West,
particularly.
this is the case, is that
Yes,
decision-makers are
absolutely.
completely divorced from their electorates.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, even like Republicans, if you look at polls throughout the past year, Republicans not always majority in support of ending the war, or not majority in against the war, but maybe something like 40%, often. There is not 40% of Republicans in Congress that want the war to end. I think there's one Republican member of Congress entirely, in not just in the Senate, but in the House as well, the entire thing, that backs a ceasefire. That's Thomas Massie, who's kind of a more libertarian Republican, libertarian anti-war Republican. So, and then with the Democrats, I mean, it's Democrats are overwhelmingly against the war. And not just voters, but I went to the DNC and I spoke to people, people who are delegates. Delegates themselves overwhelmingly against the war. They realize that this is disgusting. They realize that Israel, a U.S. partner, and basically the United States by proxy, is doing the exact thing that they watch Russia doing. I mean, it's actually worse than that even. But they're seeing the exact kind of thing that Russia is doing, and it's them doing it. And so the Democratic rank and file understands that this is bad, but again, this does not filter to the top of the party. And so the problem ultimately, it's not even US liberalism, although there's definitely problems, many deep problems with the US liberalism. It's this political system that is completely unresponsive to people and is frankly dominated by money, and a large part of which is AIPAC, the right-wing pro-Israel lobby, which spent, as an individual force, spent more than any other in U.S. history on swaying these elections, and basically cowing lawmakers into publicly taking its line again and again, despite whatever personal moral misgivings they have.
And I guess just quickly to pivot to New Zealand, this is something that we've said again and again, as kind of liberals or kind of more soft or center left people here have been like, oh, we should have a closer alignment with the US because we need to protect from China or whatever. And my rejoinder has always been, yeah, but Trump's going to potentially be the next president. Do you want to align with that? And there's never a response to that. Like people just tap out. They're like, ah, well, I guess you've caught me. Like
Oh, well, I guess
I
I'll just have to
don't
rethink
want to.
my entire worldview. Well,
I don't want that cognitive dissonance. I'm out. And here we are, right? Like here we are in the situation with People weren't effectively organizing because they wanted to ignore that cognitive dissonance. It felt icky to them to grapple with the weight of the alignment with a president they were calling fascist under a US military industrial complex, alongside this trend in the West for political leadership to be divorced from the electorate and just be doing shit, like the most heinous shit. And we're seeing that like every day here in New Zealand, with some of the actions that the National Coalition is taking. I don't really know what the solution to that is. We've just had the last couple of days, just like the complete, and the last 2 years or so, the complete hacking of, I guess, or like overturning of institutional norms. And the institutions still exist, they just have horrific people put in decision-making positions for them. So you had that happen earlier in this term with the Human Rights Commission, and some of the other roles there, the Race Relations Commissioner, just given to like really nasty reactionaries. We've just had news yesterday that a bunch of Maori academics have been let go from the Waitangi Tribunal, and some of the people put in their place are like Ron Mark, ex-New Zealand First, current mayor, has historically been very against like the treaty and associated issues through his association with New Zealand First and Winston Peters. And this fucko, Philip Crump, who's a right-wing reactionary blogger who has just been handed opportunity after opportunity despite fucking failing at them all. He's now on the Waitangi Tribunal and on the New Zealand On Air board. And he's the guy that got shoulder tapped to come and try and launch News Talk ZB Plus, which was NZME's answer to the platform and reality check radio. Like, why are people like this who are in probably like the 5% maybe or like less of reactionary politics as far as representing, the New Zealand electorate goes, being put in positions that hold so much institutional power? And it's just happening again and again and again. It's happening across the board.
I mean, there's a few ways to look at it. On the one hand, you could view it as I mean, it is a scary thing, and you could view it as a sign of the strength of reactionary forces in New Zealand and around the world. Another way to look at it is it's a sign of weakness. I mean, they are resorting to these kinds of measures, these undemocratic measures, attempting to just kind of steamroll over normal processes and just kind of pose their will, because they have lost the argument. They've lost the political argument. They've lost popular opinion. It's not. I mean, it is surprising to me on the one hand that this government in New Zealand is trying to relitigate and rewrite all of these things that I thought we had basically settled the case on, that I thought after John Key's prime ministership, basically there was a broad consensus on, the place of Maori in New Zealand, the place of the treaty, and an acceptance. And I think that there has been, for the most part. And I think that's probably the scariest thing, that even as public that the fact that public opinion has shifted, there has been this greater acceptance of all these things that maybe 20, 30 years ago were immensely controversial. It makes it more important to kind of just take a wrecking ball and try and just bulldoze over that. So that may be one way, maybe more optimistic.
I agree with you that it's a sign of weakness. It's a power grab, right? Like, okay, we have the chance to do these things, we should do it now while we can.
Which doesn't make it better.
No,
Doesn't
it
it
doesn't
shouldn't
make it
make anyone
better.
feel better.
No. The issue for me is not so much that the people we know would do these things are doing them. Like, this is what like right-wing reactionaries do, right? It's that the liberal institutionalists in this country, the people who also hold power currently, the people who were like on these boards, who are currently on these boards, who are in political positions, are like, oh, well, I guess it's within the rules, and there's not much we can do about it. Oops. And again, this is a pattern we've seen across the other Western, air quotes, democracies, is the people who hold political power, and purport towards liberal ideals or even progressive ideals, Well, still a little bit understand how class works, and they're not directly threatened by this in the same way that the rest of us are further down the line. They can just sort of aside and tuck their heads and say, "Oh, that's kind of against the rules." I guess the rules have changed now. So many things have happened that should have seen an enormous outcry among the establishment, the people who hold decision-making power in these positions. And instead, you're just seeing them either shake their heads or retreat from public life. Like the number of people who have just like left. They're like, "Oh, well, I can't work under this government. I'm gonna leave." You're like, "Okay, great work. Thanks for abandoning the rest of us to just deal with the fallout from this. Perfect."
Yeah, it's there's a lot of parallels with the Gaza stuff. It's like, what do you do? Do you stay and be complicit in some way? Do you try and change things from the inside? Do you make a do you get out of it and make a public show of it? I don't know.
Well, there'll be plenty more to talk about through 2025, I'm sure.
I actually think this year is gonna be fine. What's going to happen is suddenly everything will be okay and there'll be no controversies. And we'll just have kind of a nice, breezy year. Maybe someone will lose some papers, misplace them, put them in the wrong drawer.
Yeah,
And
leave them on a
there'll
suitcase
be
on
some
the
inquiry about it. I think all of us in New Zealand, in the world, will just kind of keep moving down the river, having a nice little pleasant voyage. We'll just we have a year off, and then 2026 maybe we'll get
2026
we'll
twice as bad.
this one's just, it'll be nice, it'll be a sweet little time.
Well, you heard it here first, folks. The worst prediction for 2025. Thank you so much for joining me, Branko. It's been great.
Yeah, good to be back.
And thank you, everyone, for listening. I'll chuck the article from Kieran Kelly in the summary if you want to have a read of that, called The Monster Making Machine, about the way that the genocide has been covered by Western media. Other than that, share, like, subscribe. Patreon links in the summary as well. Give us some money. And we'll catch you next week for more current events. See you then.
If artifices are denied, live in a pointless life, but learning all your lessons from your politics is no distinction. The words upon now is paid with good intentions. And I'll admit that I'm at a loss for what to say when they criticize the cost you ought to stay. Cause I live amongst the people every day. This vindictive, forgetful fucking rain. It feels like we're on the road to hell.